This is the SNL Friday Night Speaker Meeting held at El Paseo Shopping Center, Room 120 in San Jose, California, on July 29, 1994. Tonight's 10-minute speaker is Don Z of San Jose, California. The one-hour speaker is Patty Kay of Sacramento, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hey, my name is Don. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Don.
And I've never had it so good, and it is not my fault. Welcome to the new people. Like I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I remember the first few meetings I came to, first few days being around here, first few months of having the old wet blanket on the brain. Can't hear me. Well, how's that? Okay. Give the man a pencil. Anyway, where did that come from? I don't know. But welcome here. Like I say, I'm an alcoholic. I come here because this is where my life has, by the grace of God, been turned around. And I have lost the obsession to drink and use drugs any longer as a result of practicing the principles that are laid around here, that are on these walls in the 12 steps of recovery, and that I have found through you folks that have taught me this new way of living, and I have been blessed with this new freedom and this new happiness, as this book talks about, and it's just a wonderful adventure. You know, I know how it is with alcoholics, and well, in my position and many of the men that I work with, it's like you tell them to do something, and what they will do is 180 degrees, the opposite of that, or they won't do it, you know, and that's just part of our common personality characteristics, I think. But what I would ask you to do is I hear that our main speaker is very allergic to cigarette smoke, so if you could kind of hold down the freebasing and the nicotine, it might give her, you know, I mean, it's her health, and this is what we're talking about, so that's just out of consideration to who God has brought along to pass the message on tonight. But like I say, I'm an alcoholic, and this place has changed my life. I used to run around. I had the nicknames of Mr. Brownwater for my affection of the finest Canadian whiskey, all the way down to the cheapest whiskey I could find after several years, Mr. Doobie 30, and because I would had a fond affection for that hippie hay, and Mr. Pack Your Beak, because I would throw anything up my nose to enhance who I was. And you know what, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and there are some people that get offended when we talk about drugs and whatnot around here, but you know what, that's part of my story, and this is where I come, and you guys have changed my life, and you know what, and this is the way that it is. These are the people that are coming in nowadays, you know, and you got to hassle with that, you know, take it to your sponsor. That's all I can say as well. But, you know, I got in here on a related, you know, we come in here with a bunch of assorted baggage and whatnot, and things that contributed to my bottom. I'll back up. In 1982, I made a cameo appearance to Alcoholics Anonymous to kind of appease my significant other and the cries for help, you know, that I was hearing from her, and I did. And you know what? I came to Old Saturday Night Live, and for 13 days. I didn't have to take a drink. And it was the longest time in my life that I did not have to drink. But you know what? I was still smoking my weed and packing my beak right up to the door and just taking care of that stuff. But the seed was planted, you know. Man, the seed was planted. I just knew that from listening to you folks that there was a lot of similarities, you know. There was a lot of similarities in the rap. And I knew that this place was here for me when I came back in 1989 and when I was done. And what my experience was I utilized this temporary sponsorship box, and I scribbled on the slip, "Can we please expedite this matter?" And that's exactly what happened. There was I'm a Chicago Bears fan, and I thought that, you know, what a sponsor kind of person should look like, if I even knew what a sponsor was at that time, because, like I said, I walked around with a wet blanket on my brain, that graphic, for about 60 days, 45, 60 days or something, and that's heavy. But I thought it should be like a Mike Ditka or something, or whatever, you know, to take me on this this life-changing adventure. And the guy ended up being like a little bookworm. I stood up and introduced myself as an alcoholic, and the dude right behind me just said, well, is your phone number 265-5519? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, yes, it is. I was kind of blown away by what was going on. And he started showing me how to do these things, how to take these steps. And you know what, that's an important principle for me to grab a hold of, because of what I thought and my expectations, which I consider today to be premeditated resentments. I thought that this person that was going to carry the message had to look a certain way or whatever, but I want to share with the newcomer especially that, you know, it's not about a designer sponsor. It's not about who you hang out or whatever, or who you're with. It's about what it says in how it works. May you find God and find Him now. And you know what, I'm here to tell you that, you know, I had no spiritual affiliation, any kind of spiritual upbringing before I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found God by taking these steps, you know. I'm a real loving God. You see, there's a sentence in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous right before you take the third step prayer that says we were entirely ready, that we could utterly abandon ourselves to Him. And this was not my experience. I'm here to share with the newcomers that you don't have to be entirely ready. You see, if I would have stuck around and intellectualized about whether I was entirely ready or not, or waited until my brain cleared, I would not be here today before you. I just did this thing because my very life depended upon it. And like I say, you know, my life is blessed. My life is filled with residuals of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I mean, my people, my entire life as a result of taking these things, and who He has prepared for me along this path. This is truly the joy and the marvel of what today is all about. You know, the day that I get to squeeze the heck out of, and it's a great adventure. I got right into these steps and I started taking them, and as if my life depended upon it, and it did, because I thought that that everything was just going to get peachy keen and rosy once I got sober and had this wonderful adventure. But it wasn't that way for me. You know, you hear about some fairy tale stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, how everything works out well, family comes back together, all this good stuff. But, you know, that wasn't my scenario. In my first year of Alcoholics Anonymous, I went through and I graduated from God's University of Pain and Suffering as a result of the emotional turmoil of the disease that I brought in with me and that I created as I went through life. And I just had a recent experience just this past week, another example of this disease. And, you know, how many times we are powerless. And, you know, there's a lot of paradoxes in this program. It says, well, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable. And it seems like, well, once you admit that you're powerless and you tap into the power, you get the power somehow. You know, I mean, it's just amazing the way that that is. But we have the privilege of, and I think this is why it hits home so much for me. There was in my sordid lower companions that I hung out with for the years of my drinking, there was like three of us that hung out together, you know, sometimes. And we used to get down. And one guy, I got to go to Valley Medical Center. This is way before I got sober one day. And this guy was just absolutely bloated. His liver had stopped, and he was just huge and just... in these alcoholic convulsions, just I mean, it was just an utterly, really gross thing. It was a great reason for me to get loaded, and that's what I did after I saw that. And everybody said, well, you know what? This guy's going to die. This guy's going to die. And I said, no, he's not. No, he's not. You know, he's really very important in my family's life. He was Uncle Harry to my daughters, you know, and that was a real tight friend of mine. And there was a... I just said, no, he's not. And then there was a man that I was working with at the time. And I don't, you know, looking back on it now, I don't even know how I got the call about this guy. But I ended up over there, and they moved him into this private room to die. And like I said, I had no spiritual affiliation or anything at the time. And there was this guy that I was working with who, he said, you know what, if you don't pray with this guy or ask him if he knows God, he is just going to be separated from God forever. And I just said, oh, yeah, cool. So I got in this room with this guy all by myself. And I'm looking around to see if anybody's looking or anything, and I'm just, and I just said a little prayer with him, you know. And the next day, the dude sat up, and says, I'm hungry, what's going on here, you know, what am I doing here? And I just said, wow, what a great excuse to get loaded. Harry's okay, you know. So, you know, what happened after that was the dude inherited $800,000 of Victorian house in Santa Clara. He had all this earthly stuff that you could possibly need. But you know what? He didn't have the willingness or the open-mindedness to take this principle and hold on to it as if his very life depended upon it. And you know what he did? Over a lady, he sat in his bedroom with a half a gallon of whiskey, and he drank himself to death. It was amazing. Well, anyway, this other partner, the trio of the three of us, has been living in a garage for the last 7 or 8 years, and we had the privilege of taking a meeting to him last Saturday night. It was an awesome deal. And this guy just cannot drink, you know. And I'll tell you, this is why it gets to me, because he's just a related lower companion kind of guy. And he's just not done, I guess. You know, the thing is, he was just all these related disorders. He was going to take this hatchet to these people the other day, and he had this knife in his belly, and his mom was giving him all this crap and all this stuff. And I was one more time absolutely rendered powerless, and I just didn't know what to do. And I went through all the rigmarole of the valley, and just, I mean, I called everybody in the friggin' AA phone book to see if we could get some help. And you know what the sick thing is? There's not a place in the valley that takes a wet drunk. And that just absolutely blows my mind. These recovery houses that are profit-orientated, just there's no place for these guys to go. And he was ready to do that, but he just could not take a drink. He just could not drink, you know? And it just blew my mind. So I just had to curl up and hang out in the prayer closet and just let it go to the master one more time, you know. And that's okay. That's okay. You know, it's God's absolutely in control. Yeah, that's part of my past. And I was in the big book today. And, well, just let me share this one other thing with you. Last night I got to go to this little play. And you know what? We talk about a loving father around here and whatnot. And the higher power, as he may express himself in our group conscience. And, you know, in front of this play here, there was like this little area where all these kids could hang out. And these little kids, and they could watch this play and this whole thing that was going on. And they had little carpet and stuff down there. And I was just blown out that they were just so, they didn't give a crap about life. You know, they just trust everything, absolutely, totally trusting whatever is going on, because they know that they're going to be taken care of. You know, they know that there's an inexhaustible supply of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or whatever the scenario is. You know, and we talk about the keys to the kingdom around here a lot. You know, like, well, we've got the keys to the kingdom. The book talks about it. But you know what? If I'm not really in that trusting and loving capacity, am I using that key to get into the kingdom? Am I living a happy, joyous, and free life? Am I trusting this loving Heavenly Father that we have, you know? And the miracles that he brings forth in Alcoholics Anonymous, it just absolutely blows my mind. And that's where I picked up my messages last night, and I just need to share that with you. But in regards to our past, when I was in the book this morning, this is for the newcomers, this is for all of us. It's out of the chapter of the family afterward. It said, Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that in God's hand, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. And that's my experience. It never fails. You know, you pick up a little spiritual lesson, just like my partner in the garage. I'll be able to use that scenario one more time down the road if I keep on doing these things that are suggested one day at a time, and I keep on hanging around alcoholics, man, and the phone keeps ringing, and there's 12-step calls to do, and I pick up my responsibilities and the things that I need to do to carry this message, that I can pass on the stuff of my past that is truly my greatest asset today. And, you know, we didn't get here because life was wonderful, you know. If you're hurting and you're new here, welcome. Please stick around and check this thing out. It will just absolutely blow your mind, and you will, if you do these things, you will just not believe the results. So thank you very much, and thank you for 12-stepping me.
Hi, I'm Patty, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you very much for asking. I like the name of this group because it's a Saturday Night Live group and it's on Friday. So I thought, you know, it sounds pretty alcoholic to me. Had a lot of thoughts. For one thing, would everybody who considers themselves an alcoholic raise your hand, please? Good, I just want to know I'm among friends. Thank you. I just went to the ladies' room. I usually have to try to, you know, relax 10 or 15 minutes after going to the ladies' room. Get to do that this time. Okay. I'll tell you a little bit about myself and what happened. Oh, and I appreciate about the children, our meeting in Sacramento. We have a speakers meeting in Sacramento every month, and I'm chairman of that right now. I've been involved in it for a number of years, but this one lady who's probably the hardest worker on our committee, honest to God, she's wonderful, and she brings these two little kids, and they nearly drive me crazy. And so they were in the chair closet the other day, and the chairs are stacked this high, and the little kids were, you know, underneath. So I have to talk to her about that because I'm afraid somebody will get hurt, and mainly it's me, I think, that I'm afraid of. But anyway, okay, what happened to me is that I started drinking when I was 15 years old. I realize that that's a little retarded this day and age. Not very many people waited that long. But I was born in Oklahoma, and I grew up in Kansas, and back there we do things kind of backwards, you know. So I started drinking when I was 15. As I said, I lived in a little town called Baxter Springs, Kansas, 5,000 people. And I had grown up with my grandmother until I was 9 years old. My mom was 14 years old when I was born, and my dad was 15. And it was in a mining district. My grandmother ran a boarding house there, and I have to tell you that I grew up with people who were very rough people, but they were very loving. And I didn't have my own dad, but I often say that until I came to you, those miners were my dads. Those miners gave me a lot of attention. They talked to me. They were away from their families. They were away from their kids and their wives. And they taught me how to read before I ever went to school. They taught me how to count and all kinds of things that were good. So I feel, you know, I hear a lot these days about, you know, our bringing up, what caused you to be an alcoholic? What caused you to be the person you are today? Is it because you had such a wonderful time when you were little, or such a hellish time when you were little, or whatever? It doesn't matter, I guess. But I will tell you this, that the longer I live, the more I realize that I had a tremendous amount of love. Those people never coddled you. They never babied you. I've always said that if I fell down, they didn't say, "Oh, poor baby." They said, "Get up, you clumsy ox, and go clean yourself up." But they loved me, and I knew that. Isn't that interesting? When I was 9 years old, I went to live with my mother. My mother had two broken ankles, and the doctor said that she'd never walk again. And during that time, I had a very good stepfather by that time, very, very fine person, the only dad I ever knew. But anyway, the doctor said she'd never walk again. During that summertime, they asked me if I'd come and take care of her. And as I said, this was the summer I was 9. So I moved from the boarding house in a mining district, which is very, if you've ever been in a lead and zinc mining district, you'll know that it's real basic. There's no trees, there's no grass, there's no nothing. And, but I loved it just the same. But anyway, I go about 7 miles over the state line to this little town called Baxter Springs, which is full of trees and creeks and all kinds of stuff. It's really nice. And my mother and my stepdad lived in this beautiful little two-bedroom house. It had a bathroom inside, and I'd never seen a bathroom inside. And I thought, it's pretty disgusting as far as I'm concerned, but I think it's pretty nice. Those people go to the toilet inside. But I got used to it. You can get used to anything, I figured out, you know. But anyway, they had a mohair couch. And most of you don't even know what a mohair couch is, but it's real soft. And that's where I slept, was that couch. Now, a lot of people didn't like to ever sleep on a couch. I was so honored to sleep on that mohair couch. It was a big deal for me. So I spent the summer there taking care of my mom. I didn't know my mother was my mother until I was about 6 years old. And this very pretty girl came to visit one day, and as I said, I was living with my grandma and my aunt and a lot of other orphans and 50 minors that she kept, they had in the bunkhouse. And anyway, this very pretty girl came that day, and she bought me a pair of pale blue anklets. I was about 5 or 6. And I'd never seen a pair of pale blue anklets in my life. And she handed them to me, and I just want to tell you my introduction to Mama. And I was almost scared to take them, but I took them and said thank you. And then she went. She had a girlfriend with her, and then they left. And I said to my aunt, "Kimmy, who was that pretty girl?" And she says, "Why, that's Nevi. That's your mom. That's your mother." And I remember thinking, "Wow, that's my mother." Pale blue is still my favorite color in all my world. I went there to live with them. As I said, they were fairly newly married, and they were just babies themselves at that time, my mother and my stepdad. September came, and they wanted, I went back home to Grandma. And they, as I got out of the car, to get back into the car, I mean into the house, they said, "Just a minute." They call me Tootie. I said, "Just a minute, Tootie. I want to talk to you. This is Grandma." Said, "Nevi and Ernest would like to have you come and live with them permanently." And I said, "Oh," I said, I never thought about that. So here's my mother sitting in the car, pretty little girl by that time, what, about 23, 24 years old? And my stepfather, Ernest, beautiful brown eyes, gorgeous young man. And then over here's my grandma, my step-grandpa, and my little aunt, whom I adored. And it's almost getting dark. And here I am, I'm 9 years old, and I got to make a choice between all the people that I love in the world, the most. And I chose my mother, I guess because she was my mother. And also because I knew she needed me. And so I went to live it with them. Life was very good. I was an A student. I had a hell of a good time. I loved people. I love people today. It's my only blessing. It's my only gift. But it's a good one. When God gave me a gift, He gave me a good one, you guys. I can't sing, I can't act, I can't write, I can't do anything, but I love people. Isn't that a nice one? If He has to give you just one, that's a nice one, I think. But anyway, I had no reason to start drinking when I was 15. I didn't have any unhappiness in my life. Everything was going real great. But I had a couple of good buddies, good friends, like brothers to me, and they had a car, their brother's car, and they had gotten it for a Saturday afternoon in the summertime, and we took a drive, and I was sitting in the middle, and they had this bottle, and they handed me this bottle, and they said, "Would you like a drink, Patsy Ruth?" And I said, "Sure." So I took a drink, and God, it was terrible. It's hotter than heck in Kansas, lots of other places too, but in Kansas, in those days, it was hotter than the Dickens. And, of course, it was just straight out of the bottle, and it was hot and so on. But I didn't care. I thought it was good. So when I handed the bottle back to my friend named Mo, he said, "Take all you want. Go ahead, take all you want." So I drank the whole thing. And that was, honest to God, my first drink. My first drink. I blacked out. I was a blackout drinker from the word go. And they had to walk me up and down. And the next thing I remember that really remember that much was that we went to this place and they fed me coffee. I hated coffee then and I'm addicted to it now. But anyway, I got to have some addictions, you guys. I don't want to be that pure. But anyway, that doesn't sound like any fun. But anyway, they were feeding me coffee and getting me well enough to take me home to my mom. That began an 18-year stint of drinking for me. That began an 18-year stint of when I... If I couldn't have a drink, I wouldn't have gone with you. You were the most beautiful young man in the world. I'm not interested. If you were having the nicest party in the country, I wouldn't have gone if I knew there was not going to be any booze there. Don't ask me why. I have no idea now that I think about it. It just seemed like the thing to do. I did not need it. I have so many friends that say, "God, I could never talk to a boy or a girl. I could never dance. I could never do this or could never do that." I could do all of those things. Sober as a judge, but I like to do it drunk, too. And I don't mean drinking, I mean drunk. So I will just say this, that I'll tell you one little thing. We kid a lot in Sacramento, you know, I live in Sacramento, and they're always saying, Patty, is that your real hair? And I said, absolutely, it's my real hair. I sit under a hot bleach bottle every three weeks to get this color. And some people really thought it was my own hair, which I thought was kind of interesting. It is my own hair. It's just not the right color. But anyway, when I was about in high school, I've already started drinking, but I'm in high school now. I'm a senior probably by now. And everybody bleached their hair then, a little dab up here, you know, just a little bit up here. Because my hair was fairly light at that time, my hair turned so pretty, you couldn't believe it. My best friend, who's a full-blood Indian, her hair turned kind of orange. So Alvaretta didn't bleach her hair anymore. But everybody said, boy, your hair looks so good, Patsy. They called me Patsy. So anyway, I thought, this is wonderful. So we used hydrogen peroxide, the kind that you buy at the drugstore for your sores and stuff, rinse your mouth out. I poured it on my head this one night, and nothing happened. Just wet. Rolled my hair up, went to sleep. Next morning, I woke up with the most beautiful, bright yellow hair you've ever seen in your life. It was gorgeous, and you could not get a comb through it. It just stuck. It was just all together. I have not had black hair since. And I remember my mom said, she was a real good egg, believe me. My mother died when she was 52, and I miss her every day of my life. But anyway, she said, oh, Tootie, I'm so sorry you did that. Now everybody will think you're a hussy. And I thought, I don't know what that is, but it sounds good to me. Sounded good to me. So I kind of like to be dangerous. I like to drink gin out of an 8-ounce glass straight and not remember who I came home with or anything else. You know the story about drinking. You know the story about blackouts. You know what happens to all of us. Very few of us get exempt. When you're a blackout drinker and you turn yourself loose on the world, drunk out of your mind or totally blacked out, you don't get exempt from a lot of the things that happen. I got lucky. One of my very darling girlfriends got beat up and almost killed by a stranger. I never had that, but I had a lot of other problems. I came to Cal. By the way, I got married. I wasn't ever going to get married but one time. My mother was married 7 times. And I was going to do a few things in this world, I want you to know. One of them, I was going to get married 1 time. I'm going to get a college education, and I'm going to be an actress. I didn't think that was asking too much. So, first of all, the marriage thing went way out the window because by the time I was 19, I was working on my third marriage. The college thing went by the wayside. When I was a senior in high school, I was so drunk and so hungover the day that I took the test for the scholarships. My head was like a block of wood. I didn't pass anything, and nobody could believe it because I was a shoo-in. Didn't get to go to college. Back home, you had to have money to go to college, and it's getting to the point to where in California you have to have money to go to college, too. Didn't used to be that way. But anyway, and then about being an actress, I realized after a while that I have no talent, I have no looks, I ain't got nothing going for me, except I'm a real nice person. That's what I used to say to myself. Why does this happen to me? I'm such a nice person. If they only knew, you know. So I married when I was 16. I married a darling young man I had fallen in love with a couple of years before. And his parents decided that they would divorce me. I wasn't the kind of girl they wanted in their family. And I had a lot of problems with drinking back there at home. In a little town, everybody knows you. And so they say hello. And there came the time when people would turn their heads when I was walking down the street. And I didn't care for that. I didn't know I was taking a geographic, but I came to California about a year or so after I got out of school. And I came out here for 2 weeks, and as I always say, like all good Okies, I've stayed ever since. But and I used to tell the joke about the difference between a rich Okie and a poor one. The rich Okie's got 2 mattresses on his car instead of just one. And I always tell everybody that to know where I stood in the economic world, I didn't have any mattresses at the time. I slept on the floor, so I came to a place called Auburn, California. I was terribly disappointed in that place because I had a vision of what California was. All palm trees and streets paved with gold, Wine ran down the alleys, and it was wonderful. And Auburn, California was not this way. Just a real tiny little town up there in the foothills, you know. But anyway, they let you drink as much as you wanted and as often as you wanted. I got a job. I stayed. My mother was here. I married my boss after a while. I married the only time I ever married for money. And unfortunately, should have married all the time for money. But anyway, no, I shouldn't. But anyway, I married the second time for money. Darling, fine person. He deserved better than me. I can tell you that for sure. And as a matter of fact, we both decided that about 3 months after. And so that went by the wayside. And I went to Reno and got a divorce. And in Reno, you've heard, if you've been around this program for a while, you've heard the expression, yet. Have you had your yets? Has that happened? You're eligible too. Has this happened to you? Have you had a blackout? Have you waked up with a person you've never seen before in your entire life, in a town you've never been to, and whatever, whatever, whatever. But all these yets, I think, happened to me in Reno, Nevada. And in those days, it was a swinging town. It was big time. It was sophisticated. And I've always wanted to be sophisticated. I have never made it. And I'm getting to the age where I ain't going to, I'm afraid. But I'll tell you something. It was just wonderful. I dated this singer, and everybody was drunker than skunks most of the time and getting well during the day. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful way to live, I thought. I didn't last up there very long. I started running out of money, and my landlady kept my clothes, and I never had anybody do me that way before. I said, but I'll pay you. You don't understand. She says, when I get the money, you can have your clothes. Never did get those clothes. So I came back to Auburn, and I had another job, met another young man not too long after, and married again not too long after. A marriage lasted 26 years. That gentleman brought me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. What happened is that we had four children, and we had a wonderful life. I started to say a pretty good life. We had a good life. We made a very good living, and I was very pleased and very happy. And yet I had to run away from home frequently. I ran away from home, and I'll tell you about this one time. I used to go to Southern California and used to go to Hollywood. It used to be a really nice town. And what I'd do is that everybody'd be sleeping in the afternoon. Perhaps I'd take my shower. I'd walk away from our house, which was out of Auburn a bit, and I'd be barefoot because I thought, if I'm barefooted, they won't think I'm going anyplace, right? So I'd go downtown. I'd write a hot check for $30 or something. Don't ever write a hot check for big time because they'll get you. But if you write one for $30, they'll cash it in a minute. So I'd write a hot check for $30 because my husband wouldn't let me have a banking account at that time. So anyway, then I go over to Sacramento and I buy a bottle at the bus station, go upstairs, ladies' room, and drink the bottle, and then get on the bus and go to Hollywood. I'd get a room and I'd stay. One time, I knew I was going to stay. I knew I couldn't handle it anymore. I was suicidal. I couldn't handle life on life's terms that you guys talk about all the time, okay? I couldn't handle anything. Life was too painful. It wasn't working at all for me. I can remember that I took out all my ID so they wouldn't know who I was. I took a phony name, which was a weird name, Ruth Blue. Does that sound normal to you? My middle name is Ruth, and my favorite color is blue. So I wasn't very imaginative. In any event, I got a job in a dress shop on Hollywood Boulevard, and I was determined to make a new life for myself. I was determined to forget that I'd ever been in Auburn, California, that I'd ever had four children, that I'd ever been married. I just was able to forget. My mother was still alive then. And the thing that, my God, you see, I'm so very, very delighted and grateful that I have a personal relationship with this higher power that you and I talk about and that we read about in our steps. I'm so glad, because I started that a long time before I ever even started drinking. And I used to feel I wasn't good enough to pray, so I wouldn't pray. But I'm going to tell you something. Even though I didn't pray, and even though I was drinking, and even though I abandoned him, I call him Father, he never abandoned me, not for a minute, not for a time. I'm there in Hollywood. I'm so lonely, I could die. I mean, there's a song, the name of that, right? I'm so lonely, I could die. But anyway, I was hurting, and hurting bad, but I couldn't go back home. I knew that. I could not go. So I was working at this dress shop, and it was on a Saturday. And in those days, Hollywood had a lot of wonderful stores, and the streets were really, really crowded with people shopping at that time. And I went out for lunch, and I was walking through the crowd to get to a hamburger place or something. And all at once, I heard this child. And I heard this child say, "Mommy." And I turned around really fast. And it wasn't my child, of course. It was some other child. And I stood there on Hollywood Boulevard with all those people all around me, and I put my head up and I said, "Okay, dear Father, I understand. As long as I live, every time a kid yells, 'Mommy,' I'm going to turn around." And I said out loud, "You going to be able to handle that?" I said, "Nope." "Nope." I went back, didn't even go back to the store, went back to my room, packed my little stuff, got the bus, and went back home. I had a lot of stories like that to tell about when I tried to leave, when I tried to get away from me. I was very suicidal. I had very, very sincere suicide attempts with stomach being pumped and a whole bunch of other things. Life was not a bowl of cherries at that time. What happened is my husband and I were separated. I was trying to raise the kids by myself. I was working at a radio station making $200 a month. I was making a couple more $100 if I could run him down. And I was frightened one more time. I don't know about you. If you know a lot of alcoholics, I know a lot of alcoholics. A lot of people, almost everybody I know is a recovering alcoholic because that's my life. But I don't know of one of you that I've ever talked to or known or heard that we didn't live with fear of one kind or another. Man, I was so afraid. I couldn't pay the bills. I couldn't do anything. I'm drinking. I got to where I was drinking on a daily basis. I'd never done that before. I had never been a lone drinker. I'm a bar drinker. I'm a party person. I love people. I don't want to sit home and drink by myself. But what I found is that I didn't have money to drink with you. I didn't have money enough to drink enough to share with you. So I had to stay home. One day my husband came to see me, and he said, "Would you come out into the parking lot, Patty? I'd like to talk to you for a minute." So I went out there. Usually we fought like cats and dogs. We had horrible, horrible fights. I had hit the butcher knife one time with the absolute attempt and idea that I was going to kill him. I would have if I hadn't passed out first. And that's a fact of life. I would have done it. I knew that. So you see, don't ever think. Sometimes you see a little person like me and you think, "Ha, no way." Don't ever think that. Don't ever think that. I know how I feel. I remember going through it. I remember thinking, okay, the cops will come. They were at our house a lot anyway. They're always knocking out windows and stuff. But I thought, they'll come. The children will go with Mama. And I don't know what they'll do with me, but at least it'll be ended. At least it will be ended. I have to do something. But anyway, so he talked to me. We talked pleasantly that day, and he said, "Do you ever think that most of our problems has been because of our drinking?" And I said, "No, I hadn't thought about that." And he said, "Well, I have, Patty. What would you think if I went to that alcoholic club that Floyd Bowers told me about a long time ago?" I didn't know what he's talking about, but it sounded good to me. "Oh, you know another thing that he said? What would you think if we got our family back together again and we went to that alcoholic club?" And you know what the magic words for me was? Get our family back together again. I was tired of footing the bills. I was tired of being glad that my phone had been cut off because I didn't have to have the bill collectors. I was tired of having to walk on the other side of the street because people that I owed were walking on this side. Auburn's a little town. It's like Baxter. It's got 5,000 people, and you see people all the time that you know and that you owe. And I thought, oh, goody, if we can get Bob back, kids will have their dad back, whom they adored. I'll have a husband back to foot the bills, to take the responsibility. I was not a very nice person. I'm not a perfect person, by long ways away from that. But I'm a better person than I was then, believe me. I came to AA in Roseville, which is very close to Auburn. There was no AA at that time. And it was upstairs, and walked in there, and there's one long table, and there's a whole several people there, maybe not more than 12. Three of them were ladies. And they just turned around and smiled like, "Good to see you." So later on, somebody said, I said, "It looked like you guys were waiting for us." They said, "Hell, Patty, we've been waiting for you for a lot of years, you know." They had seen me in action. They had seen us in action. They had known the story. You don't go in a little town like Auburn and pull the shenanigans we pulled and get, you know, and not know. Everybody knows about it. So anyway, I really loved AA. I thought, gee, boy, this is great. I'm glad he's got it. He needs it. And then I never thought, so help me, never thought I needed it. I never thought I was alcoholic. I am an Okie. You don't understand. In Oklahoma, as you're raised, in my family, you do not tell people your troubles. You do not be a namby-pamby, you know. You do not, as my friend from North Sacramento used to say, this ain't no program for jelly beans. You don't be a jelly bean. That's what I used to think. You don't tell people what's going on in your life. You just go with it. You put it on your shoulders and you work it out and go on about your business. And then I come to these people that said, share with us, Patty. And I listen to them talk and they tell everything there is to tell about their life. They seem to trust each other, which I thought was interesting. They seem to love each other, which I loved. And they felt warm toward each other, which I wanted desperately. I'm so lonely. Alcoholism is the lonely disease. You and I know that, don't we? It's the lonely disease. You can be alone, as I have been many times, in a crowd full of people. In a nice house with nice music and loads of people and everybody having a good time and you're dying of loneliness. I have been there. I know how it is. So I came to you. Heck, I came to those meetings for about a year. I never lied to you because I didn't want to lie to you. I didn't think it was alcoholic. Came to those meetings. Even went to a conference one time and there was AA people over here and there's Al-Anon over here. Didn't even know what Al-Anon was. I didn't think those folks drank. I knew I wouldn't want anything to do with them, you know. And I certainly didn't think it was alcoholic. And I remember standing there, seriously, it was in Chico. I remember standing in the middle, kind of between the two tables, and thinking to myself, you ain't nothing, Patty. Neither one. And, you know, we don't like to be that. We don't like to be a nothing. We kind of like to be something. My turning point, the book says that there is a turning point that each of us have. And my turning point was this. Now, first of all, I want to tell you what I have learned in this program. I have learned, this is my opinion, only mine, nobody else's. But I have a power greater than myself. I happen to call him Father. It's my God as I understand him. He talks to me all the time. He tells me what to do. He guides me. He does not come down here and say, hey, Patty, do this, do that. He puts somebody in my life that says, hey, Patty, did you do that? Or puts somebody in my life that I can look at. I can think, oh boy, they handled that well. I admire them for that. I hope I can do that. You know, he puts somebody in our lives. Every one of us, I sincerely, honest to God, believe that. Puts somebody in our life that says something. Maybe it's been said to us a million times and we haven't heard it. And all at once, there's somebody that we listen to. I was coming from the Roseville meeting. I was going from the main meeting room into the kitchen this one night. And this fellow that I just loved, his name was Dell, came up and he said, hi, sweetheart. Don't you think it's about time you got honest with Patty? And I didn't look at him and say, what are you talking about, Dell? I said, yeah, Dell, I think so. And I went on a little further into the kitchen to put my coffee cup in the sink. We had regular coffee cups in those days. And another man came up to me. Didn't even know the other guy talked to me. And his name was A.A. Ray. And he and his wife were real good friends of mine. He was an artist. And he said, Patty, I've been thinking about you, honey. And he says, don't you think it's about time you make a decision about your alcoholism? And I said, yes, yes I do, Ray. Thank you. I went home and I was determined not to ever go to another Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I thought, those people infringe on my privacy, and I'm not going back. I don't identify with them. Those three of those ladies, they were beautiful. Their hair was so perfect. They wore beautiful clothes. They'd all been in jail. I mean, I had never been in jail. I thought, I must be better than this. Now, I did not let them know that I had been in the nut house, you mind. But we were different, and they had not ever been in the nut house. Later we found out, you know, we kind of matched stories, you know, can you top this routine? But anyway, so what happened is that I just didn't identify, didn't think it's supposed to. I looked for all the differences, and please, if you're a newcomer, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't look for the differences. Look for the similarities. And don't look for the experiences to be the same, because they're not going to be. But the feelings are going to be the same. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of feelings. emotions. We've been different places. We've done different things. We're different colors and different ages and different everything. But inside our hearts, we've had the same feeling. Just think about that. I couldn't think about that then. I did decide to read the book for me, just for the heck of it, okay? I read the book and I tried to take the steps. And I read the part that said, if there's any doubt in your mind that you're alcoholic, try some controlled drinking. I thought, wonderful. That's what I'll do. There's certainly some doubt in my mind. I've been going to those meetings for over a year. I had not been drinking. I was afraid to. I was afraid that my husband would leave. I'd lose my home again. I'd lose my family again. And I didn't dare drink. I was scared to death of it. Scared, that's okay. If you're scared of it, that's okay to be scared, I think. I was. But the deal was is that I just decided that I would try. I thought, okay, I have a $20 bill dust away here. I'm going to go over to Woodland and have a little drunk for myself. There is some doubt in my mind that I'm alcoholic. I don't want to lie to those people, and I don't want to lie to me, okay? And I have to tell you that this God that I was telling you about, this power greater than ourselves, gave me this wonderful experience. In my year that I had been going to AA with my husband, not admitting I was alcoholic, just taking his inventory at every opportunity, I had heard a speaker. Perhaps some of you have heard of him. He was a judge. His name was Judge Ray something or other, and he was from Des Moines, Iowa. I had heard him speak at the Memorial Auditorium in Sacramento, an AA talk. He was a very large man, and he had this great big laugh, and he had this great big smile. Ho, 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 you know, that type. So anyway, I am getting dressed, ready to go over to Woodland to have a little drunk for myself. And all at once, so help me God, into my mind's eye comes this man's face. Into my ears comes this man's voice. And this man says, you know what alcoholics are? They're the kind of people that just can't predict what will happen if they have one drink. And I stood there in my bedroom and I thought, I can't predict what will happen if I just have one drink. And then I thought, Patty, you're an alcoholic just like those folks. Just like them. So about 3 or 4 days later, I did go to a meeting in within Grass Valley. A good friend of mine was having a one-year birthday. He called on me, and I said, I stood up and I said, my name is Patty, and I'm an alcoholic. Now I have to tell you what. This program, my giving up, my surrendering, has brought to me everything that I looked for out there in spades. It has been a hard row, of course. It's like they say to the newcomer, fasten your seat belts. It's going to be a bumpy ride. It is a bumpy ride sometimes. You better believe it is. But there's days when it's wonderful. There's days when there's peace of mind and joy in your heart. And you always know somewhere back there that even though it's tough today, it's going to be okay later. You know, later it's going to be okay. You're going to get through this. You're going to get through this because you want to get through it. You don't want to give up. Do you know what? I used to think I was so weak. I used to think I had no character. I had no guts. I couldn't handle anything. I was wrong. You better believe I still can't handle anything. But you see, I have this wonderful, wonderful partner. But I also heard another man early in my sobriety. His name was Chuck Chamberlain. And I remember him saying he had a wonderful partner in life. They go through life laughing, talking together. I remember hearing him say that. And I thought, boy, I wish I could do that. He said, I drive down the road and I talk to my God and I sing with him. And we're partners, we're buddies in this endeavor of life. I remember thinking, I wish it could be that way. You know, I am that way now. I am that way now. When I'm driving alone, I talk a lot. I talk anyway, as you can probably tell. But I'm a talker and I hope I'm a doer a little bit. But I talk to my God just as I'm talking to you because you are my God. You're how I see him. You're what he is to me. Now I want to tell you, okay, so I'm there at that meeting and I say I'm Patty, I'm an alcoholic. I'll tell you one of the greatest experiences of my life. I had always before gone to a lot of meetings. My first sponsor was one of the first 9 people sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in Northern California. So he was a very popular man, Some of the people that are a little bit older perhaps remember him. By the way, that date was the 15th of December, 1958. So I've been sober a long time. I've been sober 35 and a half years. And thank you. And just to prove to you that this is indeed a program of miracles, I'm only 39. I tell everybody that, and nobody says anything about it so far, so I'm going to keep doing it. As Johnny says, keep doing what you're doing, you'll get what you're getting. Okay, now, early on, I went to a lot of meetings, and I was so privileged because I just don't go to one meeting to this day. I believe that each meeting has a personality, you know? We can't put our finger on it, but it's there. I go to a lot of meetings. I know a lot of people, and I love that. And I was broken in. That was my kindergarten in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're also told to choose some. Either do H&I or do, you know, general service or whatever. I used to do a lot of 12-step calls. I have some funny 12-step calls, but I don't think I got time to tell you about them except this one. First 12-step call I ever went in, I am newly sober. I mean, I am ready to save the world, okay? You just stand back. Don't get in my way. So I didn't have any chances. I had signed my name to everything there was to sign, okay? Nobody called me. So here it is. It's in the middle of winter. It's pouring down rain. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting there in my big easy chair finishing my book, and the phone rings, and they have a 12-step call, and I'm just ecstatic. I've just moved to Sacramento from Auburn. I don't know anybody in Sacramento. So I did know this one lady who was not even an Al-Anon, but her husband was alcoholic. So I good friend. And so I called her and I said, would you go on a 12-step call with me, Addie? Oh, sure, she says, Patty, I'll go put on my clothes and I'll be ready. I'll be waiting for you. So I go by and pick her up. We go over to South Sacramento. Get to this little house. Oh, first of all, I'll tell you, I used to have first aid kits. This may be an idea if you do first aid, if you do a 12-step work. I had what I called first aid kits. I put together all the pamphlets that I thought were really good for newcomers, right? I put all the little sayings of AA, everything. It was a first aid kit. And then you put it in an envelope and you seal it up and then you got it there on hand. Just like money in the bank, you know, or candy in the cupboard or something. So the thing is, I got my first aid kit, but I got about three of them. I said, I'm going to do this one right. I'm going to give this girl three first aid kits, okay? So I get there. We get there. We knock on the door. This adorable little Japanese lady comes to the door. Real cute little lady. I think she does not look like an alcoholic. I said, oh, did you call for someone to visit? Yes, she said. Yes, she said. And she pointed to this girl, and this girl was her daughter-in-law. And her daughter-in-law was a great big girl with real thick glasses and was drunker than a skunk. So anyway, she's sitting there, just to show you how we are, and if you're new, you'll do this, I'll bet. Okay, this lady was sitting in the chair, and I'm pleading. I in the meantime, when she goes to the bathroom, I'm throwing the pamphlets under the couch and under the table and in the closet, and I think when she least expects it, she'll be ready to take a drink, and there will be the first aid kit. See? I'll get her, even if I'm not home. I remember this. It's so wonderful. Okay, now what happens? Every once in a while, she has to go to the bathroom or check the children. Each time she returns, she's a little drunker. I don't have sense enough to realize this woman's going out and having a few more belts, you know. So finally, I get it. It doesn't take a bee long, you know, to have a truck run over me 7 or 8 times. So the thing is, finally, I thought, I don't think I'm making it. And Addie's asleep, and the little Japanese adorable lady is asleep. So I'm sitting on the footstool, and the girl is sitting in the chair. And she says, finally, would you do something for me? I thought, oh, boy, I got her. I said, anything. I'm thinking to myself, will it be money? She needs money. Would she want me to drive her to Los Angeles, to Dallas, to any place? Whatever she needs, I'll do it. I said, of course, anything you want. She says, would you do to shut up? That is the story of my first 12-step call. And as the saying goes, it was extremely successful because I stayed sober. Okay. Now, another thing I was taught to do was to make a choice about what I do. I happened to choose Alcoholics Anonymous, H&I. In January of 1961, I walked into the prison at Vacaville. There was a man by the name of Bunny Power who is now dead, but who had the nut tree, and Bunny was one of us. And he had started an AA meeting within the prison. It was an integrated meeting in the respect that it was not only just an alcoholic, but it was everybody who had any kind of an addiction. However, you only spoke about your alcoholism from the podium, and you did not use four-letter words, or he would have asked you to leave. He said, that's what we used to be. We used to talk like that when we were on the street. We don't talk like that anymore. So I appreciated that. Okay. I have never talked at a meeting before in my entire life. It's January the 21st. I just happened to remember it, 1961. I walk into the meeting, to the visiting room at Vacaville. There's about 100 guys in there. I have never been in a prison. I've never even been in jail, as I told you. Never was I frightened. Never was I even given a second thought. I walked in, and just like I walked into your room tonight, I loved you immediately as I loved them. I understood them immediately. I understand you, I think, and hope you understand me. And they did. They loved me, and they understood me. We had a rapport for 12 years. For 12 years of my sobriety, I got to go to Vacaville on a regular basis. My husband was the regular sponsor. He decided that he was going to go back out and didn't want to be involved in Alcoholics Anonymous again. The boys asked if I would be their sponsor. We talked to the warden, to the superintendent of the prison, and to the associate, and asked them what they thought about having a woman as the outside sponsor in a men's prison. And they were very, very loving and very, very respectful. And they said, you know, Patty, we've never seen anything but respect come from you. We've never seen anything but good come from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. In this prison, you're an asset, and AA is an asset, and as long as you're doing it, it's fine. Isn't that wonderful? I'm so delighted it happened. I had those guys, so many of them, not too many do I see these days out on the street, as they call it, out on the bricks. But when I do, it's a special blessing when I see those guys. But I'll tell you what they did for me. When time comes when things are bad, I didn't feel like going to Vacaville on Monday night. But I thought, I have to go. I have to go. I said I'd go, and I'm not a responsible person. I must try. And I'd go, and I'd just take off. I'd just soar. You know, it was just wonderful. I have so many stories to tell about what happened to those guys, and so many stories to tell you about what happened to their families. I got to know so many of them so well. I mean, it was an experience that I couldn't have imagined. You talk, Don, by the way, was great, wonderful. But also, you'll hear all the time that we have a life that we would never imagine. We couldn't imagine life could be this good. I could not imagine that me, this little oaky girl from back, you know, in the Middle West, back home, who had never even really been in a good prison, would become a sister and a loving sister of 100 or more alcoholics who had many committed crimes like I had thought about doing. You think I ever cared? Somebody said to me one time, aren't you afraid? I said, what? Are you afraid if you go to an AA meeting? Of course not. Of course not. I'm not afraid. I'm among friends. I'm among loved ones. I've had a lot of experiences. That 26-year marriage ended. I went to work. I didn't want to go to work. I used to say, I don't care about getting up early in the morning, but then, what the heck, you've been doing it for a long time, I can do it too. God gave me a very good job working with his people. And that was a Medi-Cal worker for the Sacramento County Welfare Department. I had so many experiences there I couldn't even tell you. I'm only just relating some of my sober experiences to you, okay? One day I had this girl there. She came, a very pretty girl, and she had a bracelet on, you know, like you get in the hospital. And so she sat down and we were talking, and I said, I was interviewing her for Medi-Cal, and I said, I see that you have been in the hospital. And she goes like this, yes. And I said, well, are you okay now? Oh, yeah. She said, I'm okay. You wouldn't understand. And I said, well, I'm sorry, honey. What wouldn't I understand? She said, oh, I tried to kill myself. She said, I'm an alcoholic. I said, do you go to meetings? No, but I'm going. I said, I don't know what her name was, but I said to her, listen, I want to tell you something. I asked her, I said, do you believe in God? Oh, yeah, I believe in God, but he never helps me. I said, I want to tell you something. There's 40 Medi-Cal workers back there. You got me. I've been suicidal. I'm an alcoholic. I know what it's all about. You can talk to me. What's more, you can trust me. when you're through with this Medi-Cal, you can call me. You think this was an accident? That you got me for a worker? I can't even tell you the experiences that I had. I will tell you one more before I close, and it's not a good one. You hear a lot of times, those of you who go to a lot of meetings, you'll hear every day's not Sunday at the beach and every meal's not a banquet and all that routine. A lot of my days have been Sunday at the beach, okay? By that I mean it's been good. I've had a lot of meals that tasted pretty well like a banquet, too. Then there came a day. I used to say when I talked at a meeting, I used to say, and if anybody's here that heard me then, you perhaps remember me saying it, I would say, with this program, I can handle anything that comes down the pike. And I thought I could. Bragging. Pride. Ego. Self-centered, selfishness, you name it. All that stuff. And then there came a time when I had a telephone call at my office. And I want to tell you this because it's an experience that I had, okay? The other grandmother of my grandchildren said, Patty, come home, I need you. And I said, what's the matter, Carol? And she said, just come home, honey. Come home right now. So I said, okay. I knew something was wrong and something was bad, but I didn't know what. I got in my car and I drove out over there as fast as I could get there. As I made a turn onto Watt Avenue, which is the main street to get to their house, I remember saying out loud, oh, dear Father, I wonder what it is. Could it be Stephanie? Stephanie was my granddaughter. She had had some real bad problems. And I thought, could it be John? That was the other grandfather. No, I think Carol wouldn't have been calling me if it was John. And then I said to myself, dear God, don't let it be Steve. Stephen was my oldest son. And somehow, saying it, I almost knew. I got there, ran into the house. I said, what's going on? And John said, Patty, Stephen has shot himself. And I said, how bad is it, John? And he said, he's dead. And I remember sitting on the couch reading about a 6-page letter that my son left. And I remember crying and saying, you didn't have to do this, sweetheart. You didn't have to do this. I had a little guilt in years because I used to be suicidal. There's no answer. There's no answer when something like this happens for you and I. There's no answer. I will tell you what I try to do, and I don't always make it. I try to figure out no matter what comes into my life, I got to think there's something to be learned or grown or something. My son, by the way, my older son, as I told you, I had 4 children. The middle ones are boys, and the younger and the older ones are girls. That son was the only one that remained in Sacramento, and we talked just about every day. He knew me not only as a mom, but he knew me as a woman, as a person. We used to write hot checks to each other. We could tell each other, hey, I'm late with the rent. He'd say, I'll cover you, Mom, don't sweat it. I mean, you know, we were real. My other children just think of me as this little blonde, blue-eyed lady who's kind of weird, you know, and I am. But he knew me. He knew me. I miss him so much. And so I have to tell you that from this tragedy, the greatest tragedy I've had in my life so far, I had to go through the loss of his wife 4 years previous to cancer. She had cancer for 2 years and died. It was like a third daughter to me, and I adored her, and she adored me. So what I'm saying to you is that, you know, life does happen. When we're drunk out there, we don't know whether life's happening or not. And if we have good things happen, we don't know. And if we have bad things happen, we just take another drink and forget it and then face it later. But by the grace of God, we have to face it this time. So what I believe is that everything that happens, I've got to find something good to come from it, okay? And from Stephen's death, I'll tell you what I think I have found. In the note or the letter that Stephen wrote, he talked quite a little bit about his mother. He thought I was really a nice lady. And he said, lady. I always wanted to be a lady. And he said a lot of nice things about his mother. I want to be the lady that my son Steve thought I was. I want to be the person that he depended on. I want to be a credit to Stephen Knox. I want to be a credit to you. I got a deal in AA that I'll tell you about. It isn't what I say, but it's what I am. That there's a little poem. I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. Sometimes we forget what each other says to each other, what we say to each other, but we remember what we are. We remember how we react. We remember what our lives are. We remember whether we're really honest or not, or whether we fudge a bit, you know, the whole bit. That's the way it is. I really loved being here. And I love Saturday Night Live on Friday. I think it's wonderful. And I hope I get to come back sometime. God bless you all. Thank you.